From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. This week, New York was rocked by allegations against State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. He has been a champion of the Me Too movement, but a lengthy expose in The New Yorker turned the tables with four women describing violent physical and sexual encounters with Schneiderman.
Schneiderman resigned just 3 hours after the story was published, but he denies doing anything wrong. He says any activity described in The New Yorker was a form of consensual role-playing in the bedroom. The women involved say it was never consensual. We spoke to WXXI's Capitol Bureau Chief Karen DeWitt, who has covered Schneiderman closely for years.
Nobody can wrap their heads around this at this point, because the hypocrisy of it is just what is so stunning. If he was someone that was, you know, known to, you know, have kind of a violent streak or just seemed like a, you know, a nasty kind of person, you know, maybe you would believe it of him more. But yeah, he was just a champion for women. He, in public, he was always nice to women. He dated a lot of women. I mean, we know now maybe more what that was about. And, you know, he participated in, you know, against domestic violence. One of his first jobs was he escorted women to Planned Parenthood clinics to protect them from protesters. So that's why people are just having a really, really hard time comprehending this, although the way the New Yorker article reads, with so much, you know, documentation and talking to other witnesses who the women told things at the time, it seems very believable to people.
And Karen,
on that level.
And Karen, before the hour began, you were telling us about a woman that you spoke to who I think had done some work with the state attorney general and now is appalled by the. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
She heads the anti-domestic violence program in New York City. Her organization helped then-Senator Schneiderman craft a bill that would make choking someone illegal. And to now find out that he allegedly did that regularly, she just cannot believe it. It's just a stunning, stunning betrayal of, you know, who they thought he was. She was in a press conference with him last fall where they were talking about, you know, helping, you know, victims of domestic violence. And so that just even seems even odder and even more stunning.
I want to read a little bit from Jeet Hare's piece in The New Republic. And his piece was about the toxic nature of New York state politics. He writes, quote, Schneiderman, who has denied the allegations but resigned nonetheless, is not just another powerful man brought down in the Me Too era. He's a prime example of a specific phenomenon, the immoral New York politician. The state and its namesake city seem to produce more than their share of men who abuse their political power, whether for financial gain, career advancement, or the mistreatment of women. And this is neither just a regional problem nor a strictly partisan one. New York has always had an outsized influence on national politics. Although Democrats are dominant in the state, the current president is very much a product of this political culture, too. New York's toxic politics are further poisoning Washington's politics, and yet it may take other New York politicians to clean it up. I'll start with you, Karen, on that. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the New York culture. There's big egos. It's very high stakes politically. Still seen to be attorney general or governor as a stepping stone to be president. I mean, look at our current president. It was New York real estate developer from Queens. He didn't go the typical political route, but I think they aim higher, and it attracts a certain kind of a personality, a certain kind of ruthlessness, a certain kind of, you know, I'll do whatever it takes to get ahead and not really think about, you know, maybe some of the moral dilemmas, to say the least, that you're going through. And we have seen a lot of it. Elliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner, you know, the corruption of the two former legislative leaders who were convicted of corruption, though they did get it overturned on appeal. But they are right now, the former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver is facing a new trial in federal district court. He led a double life, if you believe the charges. He was stealing from people all the time while acting like, you know, he was for tenants' rights and rights of the people. And, you know, he was this kindly kind of grandfatherly like figure. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I find being a reporter here. It's we know so little about the kind of double lives that it's revealed that a lot of these people have. And that's, you know, you kind of wonder, are we, you know, we're in the building of the reporters, myself and print reporters, news organizations. Are we the most naive people in the Capitol that we just never see this until some prosecutor comes along?
Let's turn now to our conversation with Tom Nichols, a professor at the Naval War College and an expert on Russian affairs. A few years ago, he grew tired of hearing people who are not experts trying to lecture him about Russian affairs. He wrote a book called The Death of Expertise, which has become an international bestseller. Nichols was in Rochester as a guest of the college at Brockport.
We talked to him about his frustration with the American public that increasingly ignores and mocks experts, and how he chooses to deal with it.
A couple of years ago, the Washington Post asked people, what do you think we ought to do about Ukraine? Should we put troops? And people were really hard over saying, we ought to put U.S. troops into Ukraine. And then we'd say, the Post asked them, do you know where that is? No, no idea. And then they'd show them a map and say, it's right next to Russia. And then people would say, oh, okay, maybe not that. Well, that didn't stop you from having a real strong opinion before you knew where it was. And that's the thing that really worries me, because that's how public policy debates get instantly derailed, is I have very strong views on this, even though I don't know a thing about it.
I think there's two separate things that I want to address with Tom now. And so we're going to stay there and we're going to talk about what he thinks can be done to maybe start mitigating that. And then I want to shift to something that's even more, that's different and I think more pernicious, which is the anti-expertise industry, which is thriving now.
Yes.
It's not just people who don't realize they're uninformed or they're struggling with the Dunning-Kruger effect or whatever the case may be. It is the lampooning of experts that I think is really dangerous. And we're going to get there in a moment. But let's take the person who didn't know where Ukraine was but still had an opinion mm-hmm. on whether we should send troops there. How are you going to change a person's way of thinking to where they're going to say, you know, that's an interesting question, but I don't know that I'm prepared to answer it?
Well, that's a great question, because the expert community, I think, is divided on this, and I am in the minority. I think most experts would tell you to use the kind of traditional Socratic method, right? To say, okay, that's an interesting point you've just made. Let's unpack that. Let's explore it. Let's think about it. I've been finding that tends to play into people who just want to talk about the thing they want to talk about anyway and won't listen to you. And so I've become much more straightforward in saying, let's start by establishing something very important. You're wrong. And, you know, people push back on that, but I also think it saves a lot of time. I mean, you know, that we're in a period now where people are seriously once again talking about flat earth theories and doubting the moon landing. So if someone says, you know, I'm not sure that we really landed on the moon, I personally will never start by saying, oh, you don't think we landed on the moon? Well, that's interesting. Let's unpack that. Let's talk about it. No, I'm going to start with, trust me, I'm an expert. We landed on the moon, okay? You just have to accept that. Now let's talk about, you know, how it happened, and let me explain it to you, and let's go from there. Because I think one of the things that's become increasingly difficult in my experience of over 30 years of teaching is breaking through the wall of ego that people have about ever hearing that they're wrong. I think students used to be a bit more humble. They were a bit more willing to listen. I think the average citizen would start with an acknowledgement of, look, I'm not an expert on European politics, so I don't know where Ukraine is, but, you know, and they would go from there. We've really developed a culture where people feel they have to have definitive, fully formed opinions on everything at the drop of a hat. And I think, as you know, you talked about the media. I think that is in part a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week media cycle. As I say in the book, you know, CNN calls its afternoon broadcast the Situation Room. Like, you're, you know, if you're watching us, you're going to help the president decide whether or not to launch nuclear weapons. You know, every day, Wolf Blitzer says, you're in the Situation Room. And I always yell back, no, I'm in my living room. You know, it's the news. It's okay. It doesn't have to be breaking now. You know, it's just the news. But I think it encourages that sense of importance in the viewer to say, I have very important things to decide this afternoon. Before dinner arrives, I'm going to have to figure out what to do about Korea. And I think we have to stop doing that.
We turn now to medical marijuana. Frank DeBlaise is a local music writer who was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease 17 years ago. His symptoms have progressed, and last year he decided he wanted to try medical cannabis. His doctors told him that he was a good candidate, but they couldn't promise any benefit. There's just not enough research right now to know how it impacts patients with Parkinson's.
And DeBlaise wrote a piece for City Newspaper detailing his journey in medical cannabis in New York State. In this clip, he starts by describing how the disease affects his life.
Parkinson's is a preamble to everything you do. Before I walk, I have to think. Before I talk, I have to think. But before I think, I have to think. It's just... It's trying to take away every aspect of my life. from walking and talking to swallowing to drinking to just living my life.
And you write in the piece that before medical marijuana, medical cannabis, I think, another interesting bit of history is the term of the origin of the word marijuana, which Frank provides
as
well.
It was because of Mexican immigrants during the war around 1910. Marijuana was vilified, and they called it marijuana mixed from the words Maria and Juan.
Common names.
Common Spanish names, right.
Yeah, and so we're going to go mostly with medical cannabis here to follow Frank's lead in the piece.
Because that's what it is.
That's what it is. And you said that before trying medical cannabis, at least with medication efforts, you managed to slow down the progression of your versions of Parkinson's disease enough to where it's tolerable. And so describe that for me. For you, at least, what was tolerable, and then why did you still decide, I want to try medical cannabis.
I mean, because I see a symptom, it's tolerable, doesn't mean I don't want to get rid of it.
And so what was your thinking on medical cannabis? Take me through that process then.
I've been hearing a lot from friends who showed me some YouTube videos and talked about it. And of course, everyone had like these miracle stories to tell. I mean, there was one video of a guy giving it to his dog, and the dog had a facial tick, and the facial tick was gone. So I figured it's illegal. It shouldn't be. No pun intended. But where there's smoke, there's fire. The medication I've been given it works, but it's sort of leveled out. We need to up the game a little bit.
Okay. And did you think, well, you know, New York State green-lighted medical marijuana, but with a lot of restrictions, at least. And I'm a little out. I was really glad to see you do this piece now because, you know, we covered this a lot in 2014, 2015, and I felt a little out of date in my understanding of where medical cannabis is in this state because you go back a few years, researchers in particular were telling me, boy, if you don't allow people to smoke it, you're taking away one of the most effective transmission means, but there's a lot of taboo around smoking, and so there's very limited use. What does New York State allow, and what did you, you know, hope to get when you first met with Dr. Horowitz?
With New York State, you can't smoke it, which is what virtually everybody's introduction to the drug is. The problem lies in the legality of it being still classified as a class one drug, which because it's in the same family as heroin. And we all know that isn't the case.
Okay. How long did you stay with that particular treatment?
About a week.
Any result?
Nothing earth-shattering.
Not enough for you to stick with it in that example?
Not enough for me to call the doctor up and say, we've got something here.
Okay. So what did you move to next?
I moved to the vape, which it looks like a screwdriver. And the problem I pointed out in my story with the vape is that it delivers the product very, very, very smoothly and cool. So when you smoke a joint, you get this donkey kick in your chest. When you smoke these vape pens, you don't. So you end up overhitting it, and this huge cloud comes out of your lungs, and you're messed up for hours.
So you were high.
I was so high, I had to look down to see the sky.
And you didn't want, I mean, we laugh. You didn't want that. I mean, that was not
no,
at all.
No.
Okay. But did you stick with the vape knowing that maybe you overhit it the first time? Did you try it differently going forward?
No, I did it again.
Okay.
And the same result.
Okay. So it's just hard for you to know how much you're getting, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay. What after that?
I went to the pen at a lower percentage, higher CBD and lower THC, and it helped me sleep. But again, that isn't an underlying symptom we're trying to treat.
Okay, so just happened to help you sleep, but that's not really what you're going for here.
No.
Okay. What about gummy bears? Exploring your own way.
Right.
And anything from the gummy bears?
No. But the one thing that I think I was remiss in is I wasn't giving it a chance as far as like a month at this, a month at that. I generally tried different levels of things, once every week, if as opposed to trying each for a year.
We'll close the week with our discussion about a crisis in local schools. Since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, 560 Puerto Rican students have moved into the Rochester School District. It's a district that was already way behind when it comes to offering help for students who don't speak much or any English.
Our panel discussed a new set of proposals endorsed by the Children's Agenda. In this clip, you'll hear Wailani Olivo, a mother of a six-year-old girl. Wailani moved to Rochester from Puerto Rico 3 years ago and was surprised at how few services there are for families like hers.
Como mamá de Guaidrieli,
as Guaidrieli's mother,
ella es paciente de parálisis cerebral.
She's a patient of cerebral palsy.
Yo entiendo que si ella recibe sus terapias como son adecuadas,
I believe that if she receives her adequate therapies,
ella cuando estaba en Puerto Rico estaba en Ser de Puerto Rico. En Ser de Puerto Rico.
When she was in Puerto Rico, she was in a program called Cell of Puerto Rico.
Ellos tenían servicios que aquí no los tienen.
She had services that they're not receiving here.
Ella recibía sus terapias de lenguaje en español.
She would receive her speech therapies in Spanish.
Desde que yo llegué aquí ya llevo 3 años.
Since I've been here, which has been 3 years.
Y ella recibe todas sus terapias en inglés.
She gets all her therapies in English.
Está bien que las recibe, pero yo entiendo que no son muy efectivas.
I'm glad that she receives them, but I know that I understand that they're not effective.
Y yo espero, pues, yo vine a Estados Unidos con un propósito de que ella, pues, me hablara o me caminara, aunque sea mal.
Okay, and I came to Puerto Rico, to the United States, with the hopes that she would speak or even walk.
Y pues yo espero del distrito escolar que pues de verdad que haya más fondos.
And I'm hoping from the school district that there's more funding.
Que pues como están hablando para el año que viene, que haya más gente que hable español.
Hopefully for next year, for more people that speak Spanish.
Terapistas.
Therapists.
Maestras.
Teachers.
Y que muchos papás más se involucren y que pues hablen por sus hijos, porque si no hablamos, no...
And that more parents get involved and speak up for their children, because if we don't speak...
No conseguimos nada.
We won't receive anything.
Wailani, ¿tiene sorpresa que esta es la situación en los Estados Unidos? Are you surprised that this is the situation in this country?
Yeah. Sí, mucha sorpresa. Yo esperaba que era diferente a lo de Puerto Rico.
It's very surprised. I expected it to be very different from Puerto Rico. Hmm.
Beatriz, is this story relatively common from your experience? I mean, now, obviously, as a parent, teacher, school board member, what do you make of this story?
It is a common story, unfortunately, and this is the situation that I was discussing earlier with special education and bilingual education, and when you combine those two and you have a parent that has to address both needs, we do even worse in the district. And we have to be honest about these things. What I'm finding is we don't really necessarily always want to be honest, but if we're not honest and transparent, then we can't really fix these issues. And so when we talk about special education, we know that there's a lot of entrenched issues in special education and families receiving services. But then to receive those services in bilingual and Spanish-speaking, that presents, you know, issues where we may have a student who was progressing in Puerto Rico, and now they're here and they're not getting the services in Spanish, and now the student has regressed. And that is a common thing that happens in the district too, unfortunately.
Okay. And Wailani, con tu hija, ¿cuántos días por semana no atiende la escuela? How many days throughout the week does she not go to school? ¿Por qué no se puede recibir la ayuda que se necesita? No, because she can't receive the help that she needs.
Ella coge 3 veces a la semana terapias en la escuela.
3 times a week she receives therapy at school.
Pero ahora mismo ella lleva fuera de la escuela desde el 9 de abril y no hay nadie que haya ido a mi casa a darle ningún servicio.
But right now she's been out of school since April 9th and there's no one that has come to the house to give her any type of services.
Wailani, what do you think for your family and your children is the best case scenario in Rochester?
¿Qué tú piensas para ti y para los dos niños que sería lo mejor que puede pasar en Rochester?
Bueno, que haya más gente en las escuelas que hable en español y gente capacitada.
That there will be more Spanish-speaking people in the schools and people with more education.
Porque tampoco escoger a alguien que no esté capacitado para bregar como niños como ella.
Because you just can't hire anyone. You have to hire somebody that's qualified to deal with children as her daughter.
porque yo siempre me paso en la escuela de ella y yo veo muchas cosas que no están adecuadas.
Because I'm always at my daughter's school and I see a lot of things that shouldn't be happening.
You told me earlier this hour that there are plenty of days where your kids can't get the services that they need.
Que tú le dijiste a él en esta hora que hay este muchos días que ella no puede recibir los servicios que ella necesita.
And por eso, can you stay? And your family, can you stay in Rochester? Do you feel like you may have to make a decision in the future if you don't have the services?
Y por eso, porque por falta de servicio, tú te sientes que te podrías quedar en Rochester o pensaría que algún día te tendría que mudar para recibir los programas que ella necesita.
Ahora mismo, yo siempre me paso buscando mejorías para ella.
Right now, I'm always looking for betterment for her.
Y ahora mismo yo conseguí un hospital en Minnesota.
And I just found a hospital in Minnesota.
Y un hospital que tiene lo último en tecnología para ella, de terapia, de todo lo último.
A hospital that has the highest in technology and everything that her daughters need.
Que si donde mejor yo encuentre la mejoría para ella, ahí es donde yo voy a estar.
And wherever, whatever place I find betterment for her, the best for her, that's where I'm going to be.
Que si aquí no consigo nada, vamos a poner como un año, yo pienso mudarme.
And if I can't find anything in at least a year from now, then my best thought is to move.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, that's 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. And hey, today is May 11th, Evan Dawson's birthday. So happy birthday to you, Evan Dawson.
Not a round number.
That doesn't matter.
Okay, well, I'm just saying it's not a round number.
He's very, very old. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Bye.
We'll talk to you Monday.
Bye.